Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
There are some 12 books in the Old Testament that are usually categorized as being books of history, beginning with the book of Joshua, continuing through the book of Esther. From Joshua through Nehemiah, which is the book immediately prior to Esther, there we find the whole series of events that transpired during the history of the people of Israel from the time that Moses turned the leadership over into the hands of Joshua there at the Jordan River. Through the time of the judges, through the time of the United Kingdom, through that period of divided kingdom, up to the time when northern Israel was taken into captivity and then later Judah carried away, and then Judah returned from captivity. After the book of Nehemiah, as far as time is concerned, as we mentioned last week, there was some 400-year period before the book of Matthew begins to record the events and the continuing unfolding of God's plan of salvation through Christ. But there is one other history book after Nehemiah. It is not a book that adds to the story of the history as far as carrying the time emphasis forward, but it is a record of an event that took place among the Jews while they were in captivity under the domain or the dominion of the Persians. They were carried away into captivity by the Babylonians. The Babylonians were later overthrown by the Persians. And in the book of Esther, we read of a certain event that took place while they were subject to Persia. Now, following the book of Esther, you have the five books that are called the books of poetry. And then following the books of poetry, you have some 17 books that are called the books of the prophets, both major and minor prophets. These books do not continue to carry through the history of the people of Israel either. As we have mentioned several times, the books of the prophets should be and can be studied along with the history of the people of Israel because the prophets did their work during the period of history of Israel. And so Nehemiah really is the last book that tells us of the sequence of events that transpired concerning this favorite nation of God's. But we study this event in the book of Esther because not only of its great interest, but because of the great lessons that we find from it. It is a book that tells us of the preservation of the Jews, certainly by the working of the providence of God. There's no miracle involved in the accomplishment of that which was accomplished, but we do see the overpowering and overruling hand of God as he worked through people who were willing to allow themselves to be used by God for the preservation of the Jewish people. The book of Esther tells us about how these people overcame a great crisis in their history. The exact time of the events that took place in Esther are not known, except from the fact that they were under the Persians. And the Persians, different from the Babylonians, who would depopulate territories, allowed people to return to their homeland. By the time of the book of Esther, many of the Jews had doubtless already returned to the land of Palestine. And there they were busily involved in reestablishing the nation. But there was a gigantic host of Jews that were still under the rule of Persia and still in exile, and they were about to face extermination. There are five principal characters that are spoken of in this book. One of them is a man named Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was the king of Persia. Another was a woman named Vashti. Vashti was, at the opening of the book, the queen of Ahasuerus. Then, of course, there is the woman Esther, who is the principal character of the book, and her cousin Mordecai, somewhat older than Esther, but nonetheless her cousin. And then also there was a very sinister and wicked man named Haman. Now the story of Esther centers around activities of these five people. The book opens with King Ahasuerus making a command of Vashti, his queen, to display herself, obviously immodestly, before the king and before his guests at a drunken feast that he concocted here for some 7 days. It is to the credit of Vashti that she refused to submit to the king's request. She's to be commended for that. This was a very dangerous thing that she undertook to do. She could have easily have been put to death because of her refusal, but she did this nonetheless. She would not immodestly display herself, even to satisfy the king, even though it could have cost her her life. Today, sometimes, you find some women that will not refuse to display themselves immodestly in order to defy fashion, let alone the king. And they run no risk whatsoever, but they just trot along and go along with whatever somebody says, this is what you ought to do. Even people in the church have been that way. We won't recall certain very disastrous circumstances, which I recall some years ago when that which was called the miniskirt was very much in vogue. And to see people who profess to be Christians aping the immoral, worldly, godless, lewd society, it was depressing and distressing. Nonetheless, Vashti refused to submit to the king's demand. And you can just almost see all of these men at this feast coming to the king and said, now, you got a pack of trouble at your house. Your wife, the queen, is not submitting to what you have said she must do. Now, if this ever gets out, and if this happens throughout all the nation, and all the wives begin to rebel at the authority and the direction of all their husbands, we will have a real problem on our hands. You know, they may have been fairly right about that, all right. But they suggested, and the king complied, something must be done with Vashti. This cannot allow to be passed over and forgotten. So under that kind of advice and pressure, she was not allowed to continue as queen. By a rather lengthy process that we won't go through tonight, a new queen was selected. And the new queen that was chosen was the woman named Esther. Now, Esther was a Jewess. King Ahasuerus did not know that. She had a cousin named Mordecai. Mordecai had been the one that reared her. She had obviously been an orphan. Her parents, for some reason or another, maybe in the captivity, maybe while in captivity, maybe during the destruction, in a way, she was reared by someone other than her parents, and in this instance, it was by her older cousin, Mordecai. It seems, however, that this man Mordecai became the object of hatred by a man named Haman. Haman was one of the king's officials, one of his advisors, one of his counselors, a man of great power and of great influence, as becomes evident as the story unfolds. And the reason that Mordecai became the object of Haman's hatred was because as Haman paraded himself through the streets and everybody would bow before him, Mordecai refused to bow before him. Now, as you study the book of Esther, you are soon impressed with the fact that Haman was a very ambitious person. Very egotistical, very pompous, very proud. He sought glory. He sought approval. He sought people to be submissive unto him. He tried hard to be important, more important than he really was. And Mordecai offended his pride. And he was made even more gouging into Haman due to the fact that Mordecai was a Jew. And the Jews were in captivity. And yet here was a Jew that would not bow before this king's official when he presented himself into his presence. Well, that situation existed. And Mordecai, on one occasion, and he would often be around the gate to the king's palace, Mordecai overheard the plotting of some to assassinate King Ahasuerus. Upon hearing this, he promptly reported it. And taking the report, this plot was diffused, and the whole episode of discovering of the plot and the defusing of the plot was recorded in the king's records. And this very act becomes very important later on in the events that take place. But Haman was determined to get Mordecai. This shows how ruthless he was, because he not only set his sights primarily toward one man, the way that he was going about to get Haman, to get Mordecai, was absolutely uncalled for. He went to the king. He proposed to Ahasuerus that the Jews were a threat to him. Now, the Jews had been in bondage. They had not been a threat heretofore. But you can see that he was either a very influential man or an extremely persuasive man. And he convinced the king that the Jews were a threat, and the only way to deal with that threat would be to exterminate them, to get rid of them. Of course, he had one man primarily in mind that he wanted to get, but he was willing to destroy the whole people in order to get the one man, because it wouldn't look very good if he went out and said, "Now, I'm proud and I'm egotistical, and there's one man that makes me mad, and I'm going to kill the whole bunch in order to get one man." He didn't worry about doing that. He's told the lie that the Jews were a threat to the Persian Empire, and therefore they ought to get rid of all of them. Well, he was able to persuade the king that this is what ought to be done. As I said before, Mordecai was a Jew. Haman knew he was a Jew, but Esther was a Jewess, and neither the king nor Haman knew that Esther was a Jewess and how this would affect her. And another very important thing that neither of them knew, and that Haman certainly did not know, and that was the relationship between Esther and Mordecai, the very man that was the object and the target of his hatred and hostility, was the man that had reared his cousin, who was then the queen. He didn't know all of that. He never suspected that such a thing as that would take place anyway. So the king agreed to this plot that was devised by Haman, that at a given time, on a set occasion, why, the Jews were fair game. People were to rise up and to exterminate them. Well, when this decree was published, Mordecai, of course, was grief-stricken, and he sent word to Esther, "You must intervene. You must do what you can to prevent this thing from taking place." At first, Esther was very hesitant to get involved, really. In chapter 4 of Esther and verse 11, we read these words. This was the response that Esther was making to Mordecai. "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come in into to the king these 30 days." What's she saying to Mordecai? This was indeed a very ruthless law, wasn't it? If someone presumptuously presented himself before the king when he had not been summoned by the king, he was risking his life. And if the king did not show his acceptance by extending his scepter to him, he would be put to death, whether it be man or woman. And this, obviously, Esther realized, would apply to her as well as to anybody else. And she said, I haven't been called in so long a time. I will indeed be in danger to present myself in such fashion. Well, Mordecai sit back with these kind of remarks, beginning with verse 13. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall there enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? We see so much about the character of Mordecai and his faith and his conviction and his loyalty to the nation of Israel and the purpose of Israel. He believed with all of his heart that Esther could do something about the preservation of the Jews. But he believed even if she did not act, God would preserve this people. Some way, he said, somehow, from some other source, preservation will come, but you will perish. You needn't think just because you're the queen, once it's known that you're a Jewess, that you're going to escape the wrath of the king. The law demands the extermination of us all. And if you don't act to help preserve the Jews, you will have failed. God's going to preserve the Jews, however. He had that kind of confidence. He had that kind of confidence, obviously, even in the promises that God had given as far back as Abraham, that through thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That promise could not be fulfilled except for the Jewish people and the Israelite nation could continue. He knew it would continue. But he said, now, you've got an opportunity. Yea, you've got more than an opportunity. You've got an obligation. You need to go into the king, even though your life may well be endangered. And then he put this point, and it's so forceful. Who but knows? This is the very reason you are where you are. Who but knows that God has been working behind the scenes and then through all of these natural ways to bring about circumstances that puts you in a position to be able to do something on the behalf of the people of God, that if you weren't there, you couldn't do it, but now you are there. This might well be the very reason that you are what you are, and the situation is for you as it is. Don't think that you're up there just for your own benefit and for your own gain. God is giving you an opportunity to be used to do something good for everybody. And this is the way you need to look at it. Well, obviously, his arguments were very persuasive. And her response to him then was this, verse 16. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Now, this is a commitment of self-sacrifice for which she has to be commended. She looked at the higher and nobler purpose than just for herself. At first, she was very concerned about her own welfare. If I go into the king, he's liable to not accept me. My life will be in danger. She's thinking about me. We live in that me generation, you know. What's in it for me? How is this going to affect me? What's going to be the benefit to me? That's the way so many people think and feel about nearly everything. They don't think about their family. They don't think about the community. They don't think about the young people. They don't think about the church. They don't think about the nation. They don't think about it. How is it going to affect me? Well, that was her attitude at first. But after she was persuaded that this might well be the workings of God and her opportunity to do something good, unselfishness replaced selfishness, and the willingness to sacrifice herself now made her able to do the great work that she did. If I perish, I perish. So she goes to the king. And the scepter is extended, and she is received. King said, "What do you want?" She said, "I want to invite you to a banquet." So the king accepted the invitation, and then the banquet took place. During the course of the banquet, he says, "Well, now tell me, what do you want?" She said, "I want you to come to another banquet. And this time I want Haman to also come to the banquet." So he agreed to do that. Well, before the banquet took place, it was one night that the king had a sleepless night. And so in order to entertain him, or maybe to make him sleepy or drowsy or whatever, he called in for the records of his rule and his reign and the government records to be read to him. And in the course of the reading of certain records, they read of the record of the plot to assassinate Ahasuerus that Mordecai had reported, and that was defused and prevented. And so King Ahasuerus asked the question, "Well, what has ever been done for that man? What sort of reward was extended to Mordecai? What benefit has been his? How was he treated, having done this great and noble service to the king?" They said, "Well, nothing had been done." Well, the king knew that wasn't just. This had been an oversight, probably. Nothing had been done, so he determined something ought to be done. So in chapter 6, he calls in this great advisor of his, Haman. And he discusses things with him, and he says in verse 6 of chapter 6, Haman came in, and the king said unto him, "What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "To whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself?" Yeah, that fellow sort of really had a puffed up situation about himself. Why, the king wants to honor somebody. That's got to be me! And so he lays it on thick. Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the streets of the city, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor.'" He just had it all figured. "I'm the man, and look what the king going to do for me." And he just put it out just almost extravagantly, almost presenting himself as if he were the royalty, and parade him through the streets, and that would have just fed his ego, and that was just going to be so delightful. This is exactly what he wanted. And the king ordered this to be done. Notice verse 10. "Then the king said to Haman, 'Make haste, and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken.'" Don't you know that man just almost had a heart attack right there on the spot? That was a low blow as far as he would have considered it. The man that he hated so, the man that he had devised this plot to exterminate, the man who refused to bow down, "I have now got to be one of the great princes of the nation that will take my most hated enemy and parade him through the streets with all of this regalia and paraphernalia that I thought at first would surely have been done to me." And he had to do it. Don't you know he did it unwillingly? Don't you know his countenance was depressed as he did it? You just sort of wish you'd been sort of a fly on the wall of one of the houses and watch this pompous egotist walk by and just see him as he has to eat what he had served. He was getting what he deserved, wasn't he? Humble pie, people talk about, he had to have two pieces. And so this thing was carried out. Well, this absolutely distressed him terribly, but he had to do it. Because, you see, Haman so hated Mordecai that he had a special gallows erected upon which he was going to see Mordecai hang. He had it even higher than usual. Well, the time came for the banquet, where the king and both Haman also would be present with Esther. And it was at that banquet that Esther identified herself as a Jewess. She identified Mordecai as her cousin. And she also pointed out the role of Haman in this plot to exterminate the Jews and why he wanted to do it. And there was Haman sitting right there. She uncovered all of his sinister evil right in the presence of the king. Well, Haman just pled and begged for mercy, but it wasn't to come. The king's wrath toward Haman was intense, but there was a problem. When the kings of the Medes or Persians made a law, they couldn't repeal it. It had to be carried out. Not even the king could repeal his own law. So the law stood. On a certain occasion, the Jews were to be exterminated. Now what were they going to do? Well, their solution was they'll make a different law and another law. They couldn't repeal that one, but they'd make another law. They would warn the Jews. They would arm the Jews. They would equip the Jews. And anybody that was an enemy of the Jews could attack them rather than the other way around. And so this law was passed. And as a result, the Jews were spared rather than being exterminated. And as for the pompous Haman, he lost his life. He was hanged on that very extra high gallows which he intended to hang Mordecai. And as for Mordecai, he was exalted to be next to the king. And the Jews then began a celebration that is called the Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M, Purim, which Jewish people celebrate to this day. And such is the story of Esther. I want to focus just a little further attention on this statement of Mordecai, who but knows that thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Surely no one who reads this inspired account of this deliverance of God's people would doubt for a moment that God's hand was in it all. This was the working of God. What may seem at first to have been just good fortune, her being chosen queen, or just mere chance, or just mere coincidence that Mordecai was the man that uncovered the plot and all of that, you're overlooking something. You're overlooking the care that God has promised of His people. The protection that He offers to His people. The providence that He offers and has offered to His people. You'll see or fail to see how that God offers people opportunity to be used in the carrying out of His purposes. And in the story of Esther, dear people, we see something that's joined together here that cannot be separated. Where there is opportunity, you know what goes with it? Responsibility. Where there is opportunity, there is responsibility. And let me tell you something else. Where there is responsibility, there is eventual accountability to give an answer to what you did with your opportunities. Esther had an opportunity. At first, she was selfish, but she took advantage of her opportunity. And before she could do what she did and do it effectively, she had to first commit herself, I'm going to do what's right rather than taking care of myself. Now, when a person's got a self-sacrificial attitude, as those of us who are Christians are supposed to have, then when there is opportunity that arises, we have responsibility and we will discharge that responsibility. Every one of us would readily agree Esther served well. And she's a glorious example to us. And I want to make one application, then the lesson is yours. My beloved brethren, it ought to be obvious to us that we live in an era and in a period of history of rebellion. Everybody acknowledges that we live in a period of swift change, changes taking place faster than probably any time in the history of the human family. We live in a time when the truths of God that we hold near and dear are being plowed under by many people deliberately and viciously. We live in an age and we're rearing our children and we live in society where the Bible is ridiculed openly with laughter. Where the deity of Christ is openly, mockingly denied. It's not news to any of us that we live in an era, certainly in our own country, when the standards of morality are probably the lowest that have ever been in the history of this land. And we live in a time when the Lord's church is threatened both from within and from without and being belittled. And where, rather, brethren upholding the truth, false doctrines are invading our ranks. And it makes us uncomfortable. It makes us depressed. It can even drive us to despair. We become exceedingly concerned about it. Rather than just wringing our hands and bemoaning the situation, who but knows that we're come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Brethren, I would persuade you that somebody, many somebodies, have got to stand up for God's way in a degenerate society and in the tidal wave of apostasy and digression. Somebody has got to stand. Somebody's got to preserve a remnant. Somebody's got to continue to hold the flame of truth aloft for oncoming generations. It may not, and it is not easy. And there are many snide remarks made and ridicule and mockery and all kind of accusations made as you attempt it. And we may wish that we lived in a time when things were more tranquil. And when people were more agreeable to what we stand for. But we don't. We live in a time when we're very much in the minority. But who but knows that we've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Brethren, what I'm trying to say is, this is in many ways a dark hour for the Lord's church, generally speaking. This may well be our opportunity hour. This may be when we can shine the brightest for the cause of the Lord, not before the world, not before brethren necessarily, but before the Lord. And as Esther did her work and did it well and allowed herself to be used, she preserved the people of the Jews. It's up to people like me and like you and those who would think like us to preserve the truth of God for the generations that are still oncoming if time continue. And what in some ways may well most assuredly look like dark hours, it may become our finest hour, and it will if we will see and accept the responsibility to discharge the opportunity that we have before us to stand firm and stand true, just like Esther did when it was put to her and her time came to have to be counted. I suppose every generation has thought their generation was unique, but there's no doubt, as one studies history, we do live in a unique period of humankind. We live in a new, unique period of the Restoration Movement to promote New Testament Christianity. And we are most blessed to be Christians
and to be Christians at this very tumultuous hour and day. We have the opportunity to take the sword of the Spirit and to fight the battle in a vigorous and militant and uncompromising way. And God expects us to do it. God does not look to us to compromise His Word on anything. Who but knows? We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. I would persuade you, we have a mission. God looks to those who are of similar convictions, such as I am stating for all of us here tonight. And we have a goal before us. And that goal is Christ and His church held aloft, regardless of what anybody says, does, or thinks. And our goal is ultimately the rewards of heaven for us and for everybody we can influence to go along with us. If we can only be like Esther, brethren and sisters. She did serve well, didn't she? That's the lesson of the book of Esther. That's the reason it's in there. Not just an interesting story about the Israelites of time past. We learn from the things of the past. Let us learn from Esther. Bless her heart and her life and her example.